Dr. Jerry Hendricks is Senior Fellow and Director of the Defense Strategies and Assessments Program at the Center for a New American Security. And Jerry, I'm happy to talk to you this afternoon discussing a new context and maybe a new direction for the Littoral Combat Ship Program. Sydney Friedberg in Breaking Defense writes about the LCS ship Fort Worth joining the search for the AirAsia flight that went down recently. And I wonder if this might be a turning point for a new level of respect and appreciation for the LCS program and what its capabilities are as we think about the overall capability of the fleet in 2015 and beyond. Thanks for coming on today, Jerry.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. And you know, I certainly hope so. I think it's time that people come to appreciate what LCS brings to the table, not only brings to the fight, but also its ability to shift from mission to mission to serve a variety of missions at the low end that are important and necessary for the Navy to operate in peacetime as well as wartime. And LCS was a significant investment that we made, starting some 10, 15 years ago, and it's had some growth pains, as almost every first ship in the class has had over my lifetime, going back, you know, to the late 1960s forward. Earlier ships in the build generally have some engineering challenges, and LCS has not been immune to that. But seeing Fort Worth on station, utilizing its side-scan sonar to help search for the fuselage and debris field for this tragic downed airliner, I think is giving the public a new view of the ship.
Sydney writes, many naval experts sneer at LCS's inability to do what destroyers can, but I wonder if that might be part of the problem. It wasn't designed to be a replacement for destroyers, is my understanding.
That's correct. And in fact, it's interesting that we use that analogy, the destroyer, because, you know, today's destroyer is not the traditional destroyer. The destroyer that began 100 years ago during the term of Theodore Roosevelt really was a single mission escort vessel that was out there to escort the fleet, to be the eyes and the ears, the greyhound of the fleet, as it were. The destroyers we have today, which is the Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, is a multi-mission platform that costs around $2 billion apiece. And we actually have learned a lot as those ships have evolved that has raised some questions even about that investment. That ship can do air defense. It can do surface warfare missions. It can do anti-submarine warfare missions. But it cannot do them all at once because the geometry is wrong. You have to be in a different location in the theater or within the battle group in order to perform those missions. And so, although it's a very capable ship, the fact is that it generally is engaged in just one mission at a time. LCS is a platform that's built to do one mission at a time. It's built to come in around $500 million a piece. And then we swap out the mission packages as we need them. And so we're able to buy four LCS for the price of every Arleigh Burke. And that's an important aspect as well, is that, you know, it's a necessary component to actually grow the size of the Navy.
I'm struck by the conversation around town and in naval circles around the world, people thinking about the United States Navy, Jerry, and seeming at least to think about these various programs in a vacuum and not in the component phase of how does this fit into the entire fleet. Are you seeing that as well, or am I missing something, do you think?
Yeah, I think you're picking up on it, and you're right, because a lot of people will look at LCS and they'll say, what is this the replacement for? And then they want to compare it with the Oliver Hazard Perry class frigates, which are passing out of service this year. The last 10 of the Perry frigates will depart the fleet and retire this year. Rather than looking at the new fleet architecture and where we're going as a Navy, you know, we have different missions to perform today than what we did back in the 1960s. We're engaged in different regions, and LCS was designed for a missile age and an age in which we're going to have to get from one place to another very quickly, and then have to, you know, forward base, forward detach and operate from remote locations. LCS has an ability to operate in much shallower waters and in different geographic confines than some of the ships of the past.
Your friend Brian Clark at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments wrote to me before our conversation, Jerry. Once it joins the fleet, the Navy finds that many ships can do more than expected. Are we seeing this play itself out with the LCS as well?
Yes, I think we are seeing it now, and we're going to see it over the next 10 years. You know, when the Spruance-class destroyers, which entered the fleet in the mid-1970s, first came in, they were reviled as being undergunned, too large, really not having a lot of capabilities. That platform evolved and evolved very quickly. We added NATO Sea Sparrow missiles. We added vertical launch system tubes to put new weapon systems on. The ship evolved. It had a lot of space, and we filled it. LCS is coming into the fleet, again, apparently, you know, undergunned or under-weaponized, and yet it's got a lot of space, both inside and on its decks, that we'll be able to evolve, put new sensors on it, put new weapon systems on it. Its architecture, from an electronic standpoint, is meant to be plug-and-play, which means we can roll on the latest system as it's developed, plug it in, super weaponize the ship as new generations of technology come along, which we expect to see several generations of weapon systems and sensors during the lifetime of these ships. We'll be able to remove the older ones, put on the new ones very quickly. So this ship has a lot of capacity to grow and build and evolve in its lifetime.
Gary Hendricks of the Center for a New American Security. But if you draw that parallel there, that that previous class of ships that you talked about was regarded as undergunned when it came out, and then the same thing happens with LCS, you can certainly see how that feeds some of the frustration, especially on Capitol Hill.
But at the end, when the Spruance-class destroyers reached the end of their service life, we were sorry to see them go because they had grown. You know, the Perry was reviled today. Today, the people who are against LCS, you know, many of them have actually come out and said, well, why don't we pull out the old plans and just build more Perrys? Well, when the Perry first arrived, everyone criticized it, and it had a lot of problems. I think you have to give these platforms time to grow, evolve, and mature, and then as the fleet adjusts, as the fleet will, you know, you give a sailor a new tool, he'll learn how to use it in ways that we hadn't imagined, and we'll make these platforms, you know, hyper-effective, you know, aspects of the fleet, and in fact, the fleet itself will change as it adapts to the capabilities of these new ships. So the Navy of tomorrow with LCS integrated, I think, is going to be significantly different than the Navy of today.
So if your suppositions, if your positions about the capabilities of the LCS are all correct, and I'm not saying that they're not, sir, does that mean that the dissonance then surrounding the LCS program right now should primarily be limited to what they cost and how we bend the cost curve and considering how much we've spent already?
I think one of the primary challenges facing the Navy today is to grow the Navy. Last year, in testimony during the posture statement season, the Chief of Naval Operations stated that if he was to meet all the requirements of the combatant commanders, the COCOMs, that he would need a fleet of 450 ships. The manner in which we were building the Navy over the last 20 years saw us gently declining the size of the Navy from 330 ships down to in the high 280s today. LCS is a primary tool for us to be able to grow the fleet to get us back above 300 ships and hopefully keep going up from there. We need a small platform that can be purchased around that $500 million mark that allows us to buy them in mass. And in this case, I think the planned build for LCS and its modification, the small surface combatant, is around 52 ships. Those will be critical components in the naval presence aspect of the Navy as it goes forward, and it will still be equipped to do those other missions, surface warfare, mine warfare, as well as a number of other missions that come up and alongside humanitarian assistance and disaster response, for instance. So LCS, I think, does become a critical component going forward.
I mentioned a couple of moments ago that my sense is that some of these discussions are happening in a vacuum, and so that begs the opposite, which is discussions about the future of the composition of the fleet in a holistic manner. You recently participated in a discussion to that end, a debate with Brian McGrath. about the future of the carrier. Why is it that you think we're not seeing more discussions like that happening, where people are taking a holistic look at the way that the Navy might look or should look in, say, 2025 or 2040?
We tend to get focused in on programs of record. And with regard to the Navy, you know, when we plan how we're going to build the Navy, we have a 30-year shipbuilding plan. These platforms last for a tremendously long time. Most of the small combatants last for 25 to 30 years. Your aircraft carriers are actually built to last 50 years. So this is not something that allows for quick or sudden decisions. And that's the way that the Navy's manager of systems has to work. Joint Strike Fighter, for instance, you know, was in development for 10 years before it goes into production, and it'll be in production for another 20 years. And so the last Joint Strike Fighter will actually represent a 20-year-old design when it finishes up that production. And so there's not much room inside the building to consider alternatives. They're so focused on looking at limited resources and how they're going to apply to the rather large bills. But I do think it's incumbent to have a time to step back and look at the broader strategy and ask, you know, what is the purpose of the Navy? To do what? What is the purpose of the Army or the Air Force? You know, what mission do you see them performing? What's the most likely war that we're going to fight? What's the most likely peacetime missions that we're going to provide services to? And then what is the most effective and efficient platforms to do that span of missions from peacetime to wartime? And I think now is a time, given the fiscal constraints with a $18.3 trillion debt and $92 trillion in unfunded liabilities, that we need to step back and make sure that we're spending the people's money in an effective and efficient way. And so now's the time to look at the composition of the fleet and to question our assumptions. And that was the purpose of that debate last Friday evening with my friend Mr. McGrath.
We'll put a link to that debate at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. It's a fascinating discussion, and I commend it to anyone interested in the subject of the composition of the fleet who hasn't seen it yet. Captain Jerry Hendricks, U.S. Navy retired now, the director of the Defense Strategies and Assessments Program, Center for a New American Security. Let's take this in a historic context, because you served as director of Naval History before you retired. You're certainly immersed in that part of the Navy's legacy. And yet I wonder if maybe we focus too much on the Navy that we've had rather than the Navy that we have in the future, and whether that might be part of the reason that these discussions continue to go in the way that it seems they continue to go, Jerry.
Well, you know, we have to recognize that we are, for better or worse, the preponderant power in the world. We have a military that's larger than the next nine militaries combined, and six of them are our allies. And that that ratio basically holds even as we look downward at the navies of the world. I mean, we have 11 aircraft carriers. I think we've dipped to 10 right now because the USS Enterprise is out of commission and the Ford doesn't join the fleet for yet another 2 years. But the next largest nation has two. And those carriers are much smaller. Those are actually analogous to our light amphibious carriers, in which we have generally between 10 or 11 of those. And so if you really look at the entirety of the American carrier fleet, you know, we have, you know, some 21 ships that would comprise carriers for any other navy in the world. And so we tend to look at what has worked for us. After all, if it isn't broke, why fix it? And yet, I think that longevity of the fleet structure has allowed competitors to look at that and begun to impose costs against us. There's a lot that goes into defending the aircraft carrier today, which is the primary platform of the Navy. And so in order to shoot, you know, 40 FA-18 Hornets off the front end to do power projection missions, you have to have three Aegis-class destroyers, one Ticonderoga-class cruiser, a couple fast attack submarines to protect the aircraft carrier and keep it safe in a competitive environment. You know, if someone was shooting back at you, you know, you have to invest a lot in protecting that carrier because it represents a significant portion of your shipbuilding budget. The new Ford cost some $14.3 billion, according to a latest CBO study. And so that's almost 85% of 1 year shipbuilding budget, and it has 5,200 American lives on it. So we invest an awful lot in protecting that asset. And I think it's a good time to step back and say, what are we trying to do? Well, we're actually trying to project power. And is there a more effective and efficient way of doing that? And I think that there's a number of avenues out there, another number of capabilities that perhaps we can invest in that would make us even more effective into the future.
What are some of the capabilities that exist or could exist that we're not leveraging right now, in your view, Jerry?
Well, we were forced into an experiment a few years ago, the renegotiating of a strategic arms limitation treaty forced us to go from 18 Ohio-class ballistic missile submarines for nuclear deterrent patrols down to 14. We were limited in the number of missiles that we could field. So we took four of those boats out of their ballistic missile strategic deterrent mission. We repurposed them to be conventionally armed guided missile boats. And so the first four Ohio-class submarines actually each carry 155 Tomahawk missiles. During our recent campaign in Libya, one of those submarines, in the opening moments of that campaign, actually fired over 120 Tomahawks that took down, very precise targets, surface air radar facilities and command and control nodes within Libya, that then enabled other forces to move in without a high degree of threat. I think that there's a lot to be had by submerging a portion of our arsenal in these guided missile submarines that have precision strike capabilities that can operate much more effectively in what we now call these anti-access area denial environments. Right now, the competitors are investing an awful lot on trying to hold the aircraft carrier off at extreme range, and then negating the effect of its aircraft embarked on board. Your average Joint Strike Fighter is only going to be able to operate out to about 600 nautical miles. So if you can hold the carrier beyond that, then you can render that platform moot. So we have to have something that can penetrate and operate effectively inside those ranges.
Dr. Jerry Hendricks of the Center for a New American Security. I imagine that A2AD is a term that we will hear a lot more of as we think and hear and read about not just naval strategy, but military strategy overall in the coming decade. Is that a fair observation on my part?
I do. I think that we're going to hear that. And, it harkens back, to that great scene in the movie Patton, when Patton finally meets Rommel, in battle in North Africa. And he says, at the end of it, Rommel, you magnificent SOB, I read your book. Well, there's people out there that have been reading our books for quite a long time, and they have figured out how we operate, and they have attempted and in some cases succeeded in finding ways of negating some of our advantages. We stay with those advantages and we stay with those systems because, quite frankly, we haven't been defeated yet, and we're very comfortable in operating them. I think it's time to question our own assumptions. History shows that the preponderant power remains the preponderant power until it's overtaken by a rival. And generally, that preponderant power falls because it invests in the status quo, and then the rival supersedes them with a new system. The French were a predominant land power until Henry V's longbowmen took down the French knights at Agincourt. We need to be careful that we're not out there in our armor right now, about to be massacred by some longbowmen.
In short, it's time for us to write a new book because our opponents potentially have read the one we've already published.
That's correct, and they've read it several times.
What should that encompass, and who should be involved in those conversations about what that book says?
Well, I think it's important that the military services, take a moment to step back, that they enable some real independent thinkers. I think that there's something that independent think tanks, such as the one that I'm associated with here at the Center for a New American Security, and other think tanks around town, like my friends, Brian Clark over at CSBA. I think it's time for those to come forward with some new ideas. But quite frankly, we're looking for that engagement with senior civilian leadership, individuals like the new Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Robert Work, who have been speaking about things such as Offset 3, these trying to leverage new technologies to take us to a new generation of warfare. I'm hoping that we can inform some of those conversations, make them rich, and then hopefully get that plowed back into the budget discussions and the programs of record that we can begin moving rapidly towards some new systems.
Doctor, you took this conversation exactly where I wanted to wrap up. We've talked about the strategic implications, and we've talked about the power projection implications of the fleet the way it is now and the way the fleet may look in the future, but we haven't talked yet about the policy and budget process that's necessary to make the strategy and power projection possible. Are there changes in your view that are necessary that Secretary Carter and Secretary Work should be working on, or do they have the tools that they need? They just need to work with Congress to go in the right direction, do you think?
Actually, I think that that is the primary relationship. Congress and the Secretary have to form a vibrant, you know, conversation going back and forth, because the military services are going to be inherently conservative. They are seeking to preserve, you know, their budgets. They're seeking to preserve their programs of record. And so the services are generally resistant to change. There are some leaders, thought leaders there, but by and large, it's as a bureaucracy, they resist change. However, the Congress, I think, understands that there are some challenges out there. You know, some far thinkers, you know, in both the House and the Senate are already starting to look at this. And if they can begin a conversation with individuals as intelligent and as strategically minded as Dr. Carter and Mr. Work, then I think that that's the conversation that has to come. And then you see things that get written in, you know, areas of study that get written into the National Defense Authorization Act. There was a number of studies that were written in that Congress asked the DOD, we need you to look at these areas. Those are areas that perhaps DOD would not have looked at on its own. And so by having the Congress exercise that right of oversight, separation of powers, in stepping in to say, we need you to look at the following areas, I think that they fulfill a vital role.
So given that desire for broadening this conversation overall, are you encouraged then, I imagine, when you hear somebody at the level of Congressman Randy Forbes say this, as he wrote in Defense One back in November, while private think tanks have done a better job in recent years of bringing their ideas to the Hill, we in Congress need to be more cognizant of the benefits of reaching into this community, building new advisory networks. I want to regularize these think tank networks to inform my colleagues and my own oversight efforts in 2015. That must perk your ears up.
It did when it came out, and in fact, you know, I've exchanged in some correspondence along those lines. I think Congressman Forbes is right to identify that we need to grow the strategic community. We need to not only improve the dialogue, but quite frankly, we need to increase the number of individuals who are actually trained to think strategically, or for that matter, to encourage those who are naturally inclined to think strategically. You know, just here. A few weeks ago on the 2nd of January, you know, was the changing of an era as Andrew W. Marshall, the longtime director of Net Assessment, left the building and retired. And, you know, that represents the end of really that era of Cold War strategists. And we need a new generation of leaders, people who are innovative and have an ability to think outside the box in the way that Mr. Marshall did for his four decades of service within the Department of Defense.
I saw your name on one list of speculation about who would take that spot. So I'm sure that means your statement there would mean if they called you, you'd take it.
Well, first of all, that came as a shock to me that my name would appear on that list. But it needs to be somebody, you know, well recognized as an analyst who's got some organizational skills. However, it's impossible to replace Marshall the man just simply because he was a genius and a far seeing visionary and a man who could organize and be discreet, which is something that's increasingly rare in the city these days. But certainly we're looking for some strong leadership for whoever is selected to go into that position. And we're looking for other organizations like the Office of Net Assessment to rise up. You know, each of the services should have its own independent think tank where people are allowed to think outside of the box, not necessarily being constrained by programs of record in the budget.